sound is.
I always get excited when you and I get the chance to talk some history, Nick, and today is one of those days, isn't it?
Definitely is, Tom. It is exciting talking about history, but we're doing more than history today. We're talking about a minority group in Greece, you know, as opposed to talking Greeks being a minority through Europe.
It is a little bit different, isn't it? And it's such an important discussion as well, because this discussion relates a lot with the Holocaust and obviously the Jewish community. It's something that we don't really think about or associate with Greece very often because of the connection with Greek Orthodoxy. But I'm not going to get too far into it because, you know, we've obviously got an expert in the room and all of this will come through during the discussion. But look, very excited to have the guest we have with us today. So our guest is a historian of Greek Jewry and the Holocaust of Greece. He holds a PhD in contemporary Greek history from the University of Macedonia in Thessaloniki and has been a postdoctoral researcher at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva, Switzerland, and the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki. His publications include The Holocaust in Thessaloniki, Reactions to the Anti-Jewish Persecution, 1942-43, which won the 2021 Yad Vashem International Book Prize for Holocaust Research, and Do Not Forget Me, Three Jewish Mothers Write to Their Sons from the Thessaloniki Ghetto. He's Director of Diplomacy, Representative at UN, Geneva and UNESCO, and Coordinator on Countering Anti-Semitism for the World Jewish Congress. He's in Australia as a guest of the Greek Consulate General in Sydney, where he's currently giving talks to universities, schools and the wider public. Joining us in the distillery today, we have Dr. Leon Saltiel. Welcome to Ouzo Talk, my friend.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here with you today.
The honor is genuinely all ours, but it's fantastic to have someone of your ilk to be able to come and talk to this subject directly with us. Thank you so much for being here. And there's someone else in the room who we can't avoid. So also joining us in the room today is the person who brought Leon to Australia, the Consul General of Greece here in Sydney, Yannis Malikourtis. Welcome back, Yanni. An honor to have you back.
Nice to see you again, guys, and I'm very proud of what you're doing for the community and continue on this track.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, we're just happy that you're starting to become part of the furniture here at Ouzo Talk.
Definitely. Happy to call you a friend now.
I know.
Same here.
That's the level you need to get to be in, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, once you have nicknames for people, that means we're really good mates. We're buddies. So yeah. Because we've given you a nickname, we won't release that on air, will we?
No.
When I finish my term here.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so without any further ado, Nick, is it time? What do you reckon?
I think it's time, mate. Let's have a drink.
Yamas.
Cheers, boys.
Thank you for being here, gents. Always
Thank
a
you.
Pleasure. And
nice clinking sound.
Nick, we've gone for a little bit of a mix, haven't we, in terms of what we're drinking. So I'm on the Plomari. What have you got?
We've got the Masticha from Roots again, and we've got a Mini as well. So we've covered two Ouzos and one Masticha.
Beautiful. Yanni, you've just gone with the water again today, haven't
Always.
You?
Always. I'm consistent.
Fantastic. Well, look, great to have you all here, as I said. And Leon, maybe let's start with you. I mean, tell us a little bit about your Greek credentials and your background.
Well, I was born not long ago in Thessaloniki. I did all my schooling there, of course, from kindergarten to university. My family lives there, is very active in the life of the city. I did a small interval in the United States where I did my master's in Washington, D.C., and then came back to Greece. I served in the military. Mm. And since then, I'll be living in Switzerland, in Geneva, where I work on human rights issues at the United Nations.
Wow.
Fantastic.
And during that time, I started an academic interest about the Second World War in my hometown of Thessaloniki, with the Holocaust as a particularity. And I started doing my PhD research on these topics, which was very well accepted by the academic community and also the wider Greek public. It's led to two books, to a PhD, and I'm regularly featured and active both in the academic world but also in the press, in interviews, in the wider Greek world. I think it's important to do that because it's important to raise awareness about these topics. These are very contemporary topics. You know, young people think that the Second World War is ancient history, but it still affects our lives today. And if we want to build strong democracies that don't repeat the mistakes of the past, we have to educate our young people about the recent history. And I think the Second World War epitomizes many of these failings of the international society and the system and our countries. And it's important to educate our young people on these topics.
So tell us a little bit about the Jewish community in Thessaloniki. I mean, we hear a range of stories about the Jewish communities that were in Greece. We've heard stories from, particularly from Zakynthou, where, you know, Greek communities were hiding, or the priest and the mayor and whatnot were hiding individuals there at high risk to themselves. What was the story in Thessaloniki? What, tell us a little bit about the background there.
First of all, it's important to inform your audience that, you know, the Jews of Thessaloniki, the Jews of Greece and of Thessaloniki in particular, have been there for thousands of years. You know, the first fusion of let's say, Greek and Jewish culture started with around the time of Alexander the Great, where he took over, was part of the Macedonian Empire, West Palestine, and he even entered the Temple of Solomon. And this is where really the Greek and Jewish civilizations come together. And, you know, Winston Churchill famously said, you know, you cannot understand the West, you cannot understand modern culture without Athens and Jerusalem. And really, this link starting from Alexander the Great is the formation stone of Western civilization, where the Jewish ideals of this monotheistic religion and then the Greek, the Hellenistic ideas of philosophy and of culture and of art come together and they create what we know today as the West.
Wow.
And, you know, we have proof of the existence of Jewish communities in Greece from the New Testament, where Paul has all these letters to the Corinthians, to the Thessalonians, and to others. And these are to the Athenians. And these are the Jews of who are living in Greece at the time, because he preached at synagogues, because it was the Jews who can understand the message of Christianity. You know, when you speak about the Messiah,
Messiah.
The Messiah. You know, if you are pagan, if you are idol worshipper, you don't. These concepts are alien to you. So these are people who could understand this lingo, who are the Jews are living in Greece at the time, or the Greek areas of the time. So, you know, we speak about very ancient communities, very living long many centuries in the Greek space. And unfortunately, this came to a very abrupt land, you know, this very glorious history of thousands of years with the German occupation and the deportation of the Jews. Thessaloniki, as we all know, joined the Greek state in 1912. This is when the Greek army entered the city. At the time, it had a majority of Jewish population.
So can I ask you, where were they? So Thessaloniki is one. I heard Yanin, they had a big population. were there any other areas within Greece we can touch on?
In before the Second World War, we speak about communities around 20 Jewish communities in 25 cities. Around 25 cities throughout Greece. Throughout the Greek space, from Crete and the Peloponnese to Kos and Rhodes, and to Thessaly and to Epirus and to, of course, Macedonia and Thrace. Thessaloniki was the most prominent one because of the big numbers, because of the big port and the big sort of like exit to the Balkan area. It was a very important port of the Ottoman Empire and then of Greece. And that gathered a lot of Jews and others. It was a very multicultural and vibrant city, very well connected to Europe, very well connected to new ideas and technologies. And somehow that became a big center of Jewish life in Greece. But there's Jewish life throughout the country.
So in Thessaloniki in particular, would you say 50% of the population were Jewish? Because from my understanding, it was a really high number.
In 1912, again, when the Greek army enters the city, when the city is liberated, we speak about 50%.
Wow.
Wow.
Of course.
So that's sort of a minority.
It's not. Yeah.
It's nearly a majority.
Yeah. We speak about, if not the absolute majority, definitely the relative majority.
Yeah,
because,
absolutely.
You know, the census at the time are not, you know, accurate as they are today. But because, you know, in the interwar period between 1912 and 1940, you have a lot of dramatic events that happened in Greece. Also, we know the Asia Minor catastrophe with the exchange of populations. Really, demographically, the city and the country changed dramatically. So the city from 150,000 people becomes a city of 250,000 people in one generation. And the Jews from almost 80,000 people, they drop to 50,000 based due to immigration and to other issues. So from 50% in 1912, at the eve of the German occupation, we speak about 20 to 25%. But still a significant part of the city, very active in social, political, cultural, business life of the city and the country.
And that's what I was going to ask. All of these people obviously being, I mean, I think it would be pretty safe to say that they would have been the majority at that time. would have obviously been holding positions in government and in business and whatnot. Were they known to be in a particular area, you know, good at particular roles or anything like that?
You know, the economy of Greece at the time, and especially of northern Greece, is tobacco. It's huge, huge industry, the tobacco industry, mostly coming from Macedonian Thrace.
Yep.
So Thessaloniki becoming a main point of export for Macedonian and Greek tobacco was huge. Maybe the Anzac soldiers who came in the First World War brought with them back Oriental tobacco. It was huge at the time. It was
definitely
a big part of the GDP of the world was tobacco consumption. And also textiles.
Okay.
But also you have basic commerce, you have leather goods, you have even typography, for example. Typography
right.
was introduced to the Ottoman Empire by the Jews of Thessaloniki. So the first newspapers are printed in Thessaloniki by Jews.
Yeah.
Even sort of like the progressive ideas at the time of, let's say, socialism or labor rights, you know, the first May Day demonstration to request rights for the workers happens in Thessaloniki.
Oh, really?
And many of these syndicates and federations and labor unions are run by the Jews of the city.
Wow.
So it's really their leaders, both in the economy and in ideas and in culture and in many sort of like walks of life. Medicine, other stuff.
Yeah. So I understand there's different types of Jews, the Sephardic, the Ashkenazi, the Romaniotes. Can you just explain a little bit what the difference is and how do they get to that region?
Yeah. So interesting question and thank you, because it's not always easy for your audience to know the differences. Even for us, sometimes it's complicated. So Romaniotes, it's a very small community of Jews. And these are actually the ones that I spoke about, the descendants of the Jews who came to Greece with Alexander the Great.
Right.
So these are Jews who live in Greece.
How did they come? So, for example, were they part of his army? Or when?
So when Alexander went to Palestine and unified all this world, many as merchants or business people, as they moved to different areas of the empire. So then you have the creation of the first communities in mainland Greece, of Greece of today, the country that we have today.
Sure.
And these are Greek-speaking Jews. All their prayers are in Greek with very particular customs.
So Greek-speaking Jews from Palestine.
They were Jews from Palestine who moved to Greece and became Hellenized.
Got it. Okay.
And established themselves in Yanina, in Thessaloniki.
Sure.
These are the ones, again, I spoke to that Paul preached when he came after what's recounted in the New Testament. These are Greek-speaking Jewish communities, small in number. They are typical. There are communities like this in Anatolia, in Greece, in Italy, in the Roman and Byzantine times. The big change in Greece happens, or in the Greek space, happens after the Spanish Inquisition, when the Catholic Queen and King of Spain, Isabel and Ferdinand, the Catholics, they unify Spain and they have the Edict of Alhambra where they expel the Jews of Spain. Now, these Jews of Spain, many of them come and settled in Greece.
Right.
And in particular in Thessaloniki.
Okay. And these are the Ashkenazi?
These are the Sephardic. Sephard in Hebrew means Spain.
Okay.
So these are the Spanish-speaking Jews. Many of them come to Thessaloniki, but they go in many parts of Europe. North Africa, they go to the Netherlands, they go to the UK, in different places of Europe. But a big part comes and settles in Salonika. And they bring with them all the knowledge of the Spanish court, because, you know, Spain at the time is also a big empire. Don't forget that at that time, also Columbus goes to America. So it's a very important moment in history for Spain. And many of these people with a lot of know-how now come to Salonika. And these are the Sephardic Jews. They are Spanish-speaking Jews. And whenever they went, they assimilated the local Romaniot communities. So the Romaniot Jews that existed in Thessaloniki, for example, they got assimilated within the majority of the Spanish Jews that arrives. In Yanina, where not many Sephardic Jews came, the community remained Romaniot until today. We unfortunately lost the mayor of Yanina a couple of months ago. It was a Romaniot Jew who was the first Jewish mayor ever in Greece. Very well-loved and celebrated personality of his city, a renowned medical professor, political activist, and also president of the Jewish community of Yanina, by the name of Moses Elisaf. And he was Romaniot from that tradition. I'm of the Sephardic tradition, meaning my grandparents used to speak Spanish, Judo-Spanish, we say. Now, the Ashkenazi Jews, just to conclude your question, these are the Jews that live in Eastern Europe. Many descendants of the Jews of Sydney come from those Ashkenazi Jews in Hungary, in Poland, in the Baltics, in Ukraine, in Russia, and they would speak Yiddish,
right,
which is a dialect of German. In Greece, we don't speak Yiddish. We speak Judeo-Spanish or Greek for the Romaniots. Now, in Greece, we had small pockets of Ashkenazic Jews who came. Just because the Jews in Greece and in Thessalonica were living so well, many Ashkenazic Jews came as refugees after the pogroms of the Tsar. They came and settled in Thessaloniki. But because the Sephardic Jews, the Spanish-speaking Jews, they were the majority, they didn't really feel comfortable. So they either got assimilated or they moved on elsewhere, migrated somewhere else. But the core of the Jewish population of Greece is Sephardic, with also small pockets of Romaniot Jewry.
So did they speak the same language? You said they spoke different languages, though. Is now, there a common language?
It's important to answer your question that the liturgy, the prayer in the synagogue, is in Hebrew.
Okay.
Now, Hebrew at the time was only a language for religious service. It wasn't a language for communication for friends or for dialogue. They were speaking either Spanish or Yiddish or other languages. Hebrew becomes a language with the creation of the State of Israel.
Right, okay. Oh,
wow. Because to bridge all the differences of all the different populations, they decide to sort of like take out Hebrew from the books of the religious scriptures and make it as a living language.
Right, okay.
And establish a grammar and vocabulary. And Israel then has Hebrew as the language, which now is becoming sort of like the language.
The official language now. Not really.
Of the Jewish people, like now, because Israel is becoming such an important center for diaspora Jewry, somehow Hebrew is becoming a language. But none of our literature, traditions, customs, songs is in Hebrew. It's in Spanish in the case of Sephardic Jews, or in Yiddish in the case of Ashkenazic Jews. I'm simplifying things a bit, of course, but that's a bit of the gist. So,
but these are people that assimilated wherever they went and into the communities that they went, but held on to that religious traditional cultural tradition.
Yes and no, because, you know, at the time, you couldn't really intermarry. So the Jewish communities would always live within their cities, but within their own districts and getting married to one another. So it wasn't like that they would assimilate and lose their religious or linguistic traditions. They kept them because they were living in the cities where they were living. They were living within the, you could call it a ghetto or a community or a neighborhood, but they lived sort of like within their own silos.
Would it be similar to how, for example, and I'm not sure how much you know about the communities here, but a lot of the Greek communities who came, you know, in the 50s and 60s and whatnot came here, and they all sort of congregated around certain areas. All the parents would prefer that the kids would marry a Greek girl or a Greek boy or something like that. It was a similar sort of thing, or was it?
100%. That's the typical, you know, diasporic experience. You know, my fat Greek wedding, every Jewish in the diaspora who saw the movie could familiarize 100%. You know, take the Jewish mother and the Greek mother.
Classic.
Yeah. It's the same. You know, it doesn't. And, you know, you always build your community to help each other, of course, networks of support, but also around the church or the synagogue, which is the center of the neighborhood, and also the shops. You know, Jews eat the kosher food. You know, it has to be special food or the Greek food. So you have to have the people to produce it and to sell it. So you all live, you create these institutions in the neighborhoods, you establish yourselves.
So the three Jewish communities we just talked about, they all have the same food, speak a different dialect, but have the same religion and the same language for religion.
It's the same scripture, the same liturgical tradition, different language, different traditions, and different food.
Oh, different food.
Of course, in the Jews of Greece, it's very Mediterranean, very influenced by the Greek food. In Germany, they don't have fresh vegetables or fresh tomatoes, or, you know, they have, it's very close to Polish food. You know, it's boiled stuff, it's heavier stuff.
Okay.
You know, because you eat what you have, and you're influenced by your local.
But I think is the question more around the rules around eating, like keeping kosher and all that.
No,
sort
the kosher
of thing?
Is the same because that, okay. the I kosher think that's is what you meant. No, kosher is religious. No, that's religion.
Yes.
Okay.
That's religion, but the type of food you produce.
Yeah.
It's very much
depends on your region. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very. Right. That makes sense. So they're all kosher. So I'm just trying to find what things they had in common. So all the kosher, all the religion, but different culture. And different language or dialect, could you say?
Correct. But the core is the same, and the identification.
Very interesting.
So would we compare that with us? So Greeks and Cypriots, maybe. Possibly. Different dialect.
No, I would say,
or different islands, perhaps.
Third-generation Greek from Germany and a third-generation Greek from the US that meet on a plane.
Okay.
That are both Greek Orthodox. They both have the grandmother or the mother tradition. Yep. They both celebrate Greek Easter and Greek Christmas. Mm-hmm. But the one grew up in Germany and speaks German. The other one grew up in New York and speaks English. Perfect. And, you know, they are both influenced by the local.
That's a good analogy.
No, it's a very diasporic experience because the Jewish experience, because there's no Israel is great 1947.
Yeah.
There is no center. So the diaspora is developing its own culture.
Mm.
Whereas in Greece, you have a Greek state from 1930. So you have a motherland. You have sort of like a center of reference.
Yeah, it makes
for
sense.
For the Jewish people, you only have the center of reference more than 100 years after, for example, the establishment of the independent Greek state.
Oh, you summed that up well. Perfect. Well, I thought we knew a bit, didn't we? But now we've learned so
much. No, obviously not. That's why he's here, Nick.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so we've got a picture of what these communities were like in Greece, and obviously, you know, thriving communities. Where did things start to go pear-shaped? You mentioned the World War II. Was it earlier than that? Can that be traced? Is there a very clear lineage?
It's a good question with a lot of caveats. We're speaking about now more than 25 communities, okay? So not every community has the same trajectory. For example, the Jews in the Peloponnese, they become citizens immediately after the Greek state is established. It's a different experience than the Jews of Thessaloniki that become Greek citizens 100 years later, you know, because Greece also develops differently as a state. It doesn't become independent all at the same time, at the same space where we have it today. So these are all different experiences, and the locals are also impacted in different ways. Now, again, my research, and I come from Thessaloniki, and that's my research, and that was the biggest Jewish community. And really, I would say the interwar periods was challenging years, not only because of sort of like the movement of these people from being citizens of an empire, you know, becoming your citizens of the Ottoman Empire, and now all of a sudden you're a citizen of a nation state.
Yep.
Okay, that's with more limited borders, different discourse, different interlocutors. 5 years later, you may know the big fire of Thessaloniki, 1917, that burned most of the city, the historical center. The majority of the Jews now become homeless because their property is burned. 1922, the Greek-Turkish War, the extended populations, the city changes, the character of the city changes, you know. Mm. The Muslims leave the city, was a big Muslim community, maybe 20,000 people. You have thousands of immigrants now moving from Asia Minor, establishing themselves in Thessaloniki. 1929, the economic crisis, the crash of 29. So really, you have a lot of big events that hit the people there. It was very difficult for them to manage all these things.
Mm. But it wasn't just the Jews that got hit. Everyone got hit.
Of course.
Nothing specifically to the Jews.
No, nothing specific to the Jews. Yeah. Just in if you're Greek, you're in your nation state. If you're a Jew and you're caught in all these sort of like moving elements, you don't know what to do. And many found safety in immigration.
Yeah.
Many went to France, or to the U.S., or to Palestine that was starting to be sort of like as a refuge, as a center for Jewish life, eventually becoming the state of Israel.
Okay, so then we move on to, say, 1939. World War II starts. How does the Jewish community in Thessaloniki react? You know, hear what's happening now in with Hitler and what's going on. Do they join the army? I'm sure there's a lot of Jews in the Greek army.
So, you know, Metaxas is the dictator at the time, but he's also a national leader at the time. It's a very unique personality, Metaxas. We call him dictator on the one side, but also national leader on the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, he's really reconciling many different identities. Mm-hmm. And he says the well-known Ohi, okay, the no to the Italian ultimatum. And the Greek army is very successful against the invading Greek army. And you have around 10,000 Jews of Greece who fight with the Greek army with the same patriotism and dedication like their Greek Christian compatriots. Mm-hmm. One of the first Greek senior officers to be killed is a colonel, Mordechai Frezis, a Romanian Jew from Chalkida, who is dying on his horse, encouraging his troops to continue the war, recalling the name of Mary, the mother of Jesus, as a way to encourage his troops. Although he's Jewish, he's calling on Mary to encourage his troops. Wow. And he's on his horse with his sword, and the Italian bomb knocks him out.
Wow.
And he's a very well-known figure. So he's, you know, he's one of the figures of the Greek-Italian war that is well-known today. So in that element, the Greeks, the Christians and the Jews were fighting, you know, next to each other, shoulder to shoulder, all together against the invading fascist forces. Mm.
Was there any element of racism among the communities, you know, between the, you know, or any prejudices between the Christian Greeks versus the Jewish Greeks? Any of that at the time?
Yeah, listen, I wouldn't call it racism. You said prejudice, and I think that's a more accurate rule, accurate term. I think it's also the fear of the unknown. As you say, also, you spoke about your experience in Australia where you all settle in your own regions. There is also, I don't know, the other ethnic group that lives across an avenue or something, and they, you know, you don't want your kids to get married to them. You don't want, you know. So it's that kind of thing.
Sure.
It's not it's not hostile. It's just ignorance or sort of like the otherness.
Well, because I understand the Pontian Greeks that came over, there was a bit of hostility with the Greeks that were living in mainland.
Yeah, that too. That? But also with the Jews, because, you know, you have all these, the Pontians and the people from Asia Minor that came from Izmir and other places, from Smyrna, and they saw the Jews established there speaking Spanish, and they're like, who are these people? We came to Greece, and you have all these Spanish-speaking Jews who are running the economy. What's happening? Mm-hmm. So there was this kind of hostility, but it's like basic hostility. It's not like very sophisticated. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's not like the Nazi ideology that's based on racial theory or on other kinds of things like that. It's mostly the basic economic competition, or like, you know. But all these people at the marketplace, they met together.
Mm.
You know, they would live in their own neighborhood, but the marketplace was the place for everybody to be. And everybody was speaking the language of each other. Mm. There was no way that you do business. If you're a Christian in Thessaloniki, there was no way to do business if you didn't speak Spanish. That was the only way for you to access the markets and the suppliers and the customers. And vice versa. If you're a Jewish merchant, you have to speak Greek or Turkish or Bulgarian or Armenian or French or all the other languages of the population. You know, there are cases, we call it a blood libel. There is an accusation that it happened in Corfu, it happened in different places in Greece. There was an accusation that, of course, it's completely erroneous, that the Jews would kill Christian babies to make matzah for Passover, for Pesach. It's an absurd thing, but it was big at the time in different places in the Ottoman Empire.
So, and say that again. Say, make what?
It's called the blood libel.
The blood libel.
Libel, the blood libel. Mm-hmm. The myth goes that the Jews would kidnap a Christian child, take the blood to make matzah. Matzah is the unleavened bread that we eat for the Jewish Easter. It's like a kind of biscuit, kind of cracker.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the Jews, when they left Egypt, chased by the Pharaoh, they didn't have time to bake bread. So they really just had the dough,
the bread
which didn't really grow, rise. So that's reminiscent of that story. During the Passover, the Jewish Easter holiday, we eat that bread called matzah.
Okay.
And somehow the accusation was that they used bread to make this
blood. Baby
yeah,
blood.
They used blood to make this matzah bread. And in Corfu, there was a big libel in 1891, where even the government had to send troops to quiet down the situation.
Mm.
And in other places, in Syria, you had it in different places in the Ottoman Empire, you had this kind of... or also in the Western Europe you had it. So you had that, and there was sort of like a basic Christian anti-Semitism. That goes back to the accusation that the Jews crucified Jesus and all these stories. So you have this sort of like very, I call it primordial Christian anti-Semitism.
And that was going to be one of my questions. Does a lot of this come from the idea that the Jews committed deicide, basically?
Correct.
Is that still something that is preached in any corner or is still believed?
It's a good question. The Catholic Church, which represents, you know, a billion Christians around the world, in the 50s, they came up with a very important document called Nuestra Etate, meaning Our Era, where they completely rejected this concept of deicide. And actually, they moved the Jews from sort of like other religions to the Christian religion. So when the Catholic Church deals with the Jewish religion, they deal with them together with the Greek Orthodox, for example.
Mm.
and not with the Muslims or the Hindus or everything else. So the Jews are not considered to be part of the Christian family for the Catholic Church. And the Greek Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, has also done great movement in that direction. You know, the patriarchs for many years, they condemn all anti-Semitic manifestations. But because of the structure of the Greek Church, it's harder to make one directive like the Pope.
Yep.
That, you know, this is what happens. So you have that in very marginal elements now. Not so dayside, so hardcore.
Yep.
But you have some marginal Christian groups in Greece or abroad, but sort of like within the Greek Orthodox community, mm-hmm. but really extreme,
sure.
that may say anti-Semitic, they may propagate anti-Semitic prejudice. Mm. But these are the same people who also attack the former Greek church.
Yep.
So these are not like mainstream actors, sure. but they attack the government, they attack the Greek church, they attack the patriarch. You know, every time the patriarch meets the Pope, he's being attacked by the same people who spread anti-Semitism. So, you know, we speak about marginal figures. Yeah. We're not speaking about the mainstream.
Okay, so now we move on to, say, World War II started.
Yes.
The Germans invade. What's the community feeling at this stage? So when did Greece get taken over by Germany? Was it 41?
Well, I mean, the important thing to mention is obviously the Italians came in first, and because they didn't effectively do what was required of them by the other part of the Axis powers, obviously Germany. Germany eventually had to step in for a number of reasons.
Hitler was upset with Mussolini.
Yep.
He was preparing to take on the Russians, mm-hmm. Operation Barbarossa, but had to come down and do it himself.
I guess the question is, when did things start getting bad for the Jewish community? The assumption I'm making is that it didn't happen until the Germans actually came in, or was it before then?
So Greece gets occupied by the Germans, Thessaloniki first, because of course the Germans invaded through Yugoslavia, so Greece was taken little by little, but within a week I think Greece was taking over. Thessaloniki was taken by the Germans in 9th of April 1941. And then as you know, the Greek government retreated, they went to Creta, and then eventually there was the Battle of Creta, and they moved to Egypt, to Cairo, and then to London eventually.
But even in 1941, I'm sure they would have heard Kristallnacht and all the stuff that was happening in Germany.
They had, but you know, when the Germans came, they didn't impose anti-Semitic measures in Thessaloniki. And for a year and a half, the Jews suffered as much as the rest of the population.
Okay.
Don't forget, there was a great famine in the winter of 40 to 41, where thousands of... 41, 42, yes, 41, after, of course, after the Germans took over Thessaloniki, where thousands of Greeks die from starvation. You know, the scenes, mm-hmm. the pictures in the streets of Athens or Thessaloniki of dead corpses.
Mm.
You know, the Jews suffer as much as the Christians. You know, there's no distinction. You know, food is scarce. Yeah. There's no...
So at the moment, they're still treated as one.
You correct. Know, there's no...
There's no divide.
And the big change starts in July 1942, when the Germans gather all the Jewish males in Thessaloniki aged 18 to 45 to register for slave labor. That's the big change in the way the Germans were treating them.
So they targeted Jews only?
Correct.
That was the first sign you thought, okay.
That was the first massive anti-Semitic measure that happened a year and a half after Thessaloniki was taken over by the Germans.
How would they identify them? Like, obviously, we've heard stories about in other parts of the world where, you know, Jews would need to wear a star on them, you know, effectively like a Star of David to say, I'm Jewish. Were people dobbing Jews in Thessaloniki and saying, that's a Jewish family, or, you know, like, are they going through records? How are they identifying them?
It's a good question. You know, you have to think, back then, people were not as aware as we are today, okay? Not only with the history of the Holocaust, but, you know, now we're informed with newspapers, with TV, with social media, with everybody's very on top of everything. You know what happened, you know what happens all around the world in one notification on your phone.
Yeah.
Back then, people were living in a very slow-moving times, you know? You had the daily newspaper, and the news there were like a week old already by the time they were printed. And there was a notification in the newspaper that all Jews had to appear on a particular place to register. And people, you know, when the government says so, they would abide by what happens. You know, you don't think what we think today, or we didn't know.
In good faith.
Correct. Basically. You don't know now what we knew back then, that was an organized plan of extermination.
Yeah. So they were cunning about it. So
correct.
We've got jobs for you guys, sure, we're all hungry.
It wasn't like this, but it was, you know, they had to register. And, mm-hmm. and you know, also back then, the community was important. So, you know, people were following what their elders were telling them, or sure. what their rules were. Sure. So if the community would say, go there, they would go.
Okay.
So they went there and they had to register for the slave labor. And this was the first of like, really, but somehow the community managed to pay some ransom to liberate those workers. And then they went back into sort of like normalcy for a couple of months.
Right.
Until Eichmann, the architect of the so-called final solution, which is the Holocaust, the extermination of the Jews of Europe, sent his envoys to Thessaloniki in February 1943. This is when the so-called final solution actually starts in Greece with direct instructions from Berlin. This is not anymore the local German army gathering Jews for slave labor or with some support from the collaborators, etc. This is now official German policy coming from Berlin. Mm. And there's no divergence from this.
So slave labor, they were still in Thessaloniki, but just doing building roads and bridges.
Correct.
Or whatever.
All across the country, in mines, in railway construction, airports.
Yeah.
And this, it's interesting because when we speak about history, the Jews that they gathered, these are the ones who fought in the Greek-Italian War.
Mm.
These are the heroes of the Albanian epos, as we say, the Albanian
conflict,
the Albanian struggle.
Yeah.
And these are the same ones that they got for slave labor. These are the same age group.
Mm.
And many of them were war veterans. And actually, they were protest by the war veterans associations in support of their Jewish brother in arms.
Right.
But the Germans didn't care, of course. And they were taken for slave labor anyway.
Mm.
So would there have been whispers at this time of what was happening further north with the other communities, like, you know, our people are being gathered up and taken elsewhere?
There were, but, you know, again, nothing was clear. Nothing was clear cut.
It's more like rumors. Yeah.
There were rumors, and there were a lot of rumors. And it was very hard to know what to believe. And the Germans were playing this misinformation game. And even the news, even if they knew what was happening, I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. In August 1942, one of the founders of the organization that I work for, the World Jewish Congress, in Geneva, he sent a telegram to the UK and to the US, speaking about the existence of gas chambers. It was the first information sent. He was based on German whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
A German industrialist told him the news, and he sent the information to the UK and to the US in August 1942. First time the West learns about the organized plan of the Germans to annihilate the Jews of Europe. They didn't believe them.
Mm.
Right.
Nobody took any action for months until they had to check the information. And even the Jews themselves didn't act on that information because they also thought nobody could believe, even today when you told me they created camps to gas people and to... Nobody can even
believe that in a war as well. What a waste of troops!
Correct. Even today, many times I say, how could they do that?
Yeah.
You know, the German, the people of Goethe and of Mozart, you know, to have camps to kill people, and you know, trains transporting Jews had priority over military trains.
Mm.
So they would sacrifice their war effort to kill civilians, to kill women, children, elderly mothers. You know. For what military value? But that also comes back to the craziness of this Nazi ideology, which unfortunately we have people who support it today. That I guess we can come later on. But the whole Nazi war was based on these ridiculous ideologies that made no sense. That, of course, the Jews were the first victims. They were the ones that were targeted. But, you know, we had 6 million Jewish victims in the Holocaust, but you had another 50 million that died throughout the continent.
Yeah.
So... You know, anti-Semitism kills Jews, but many others are also killed because of crazy anti-Semitic ideas.
Yeah, but there were more than just Jews that died at Auschwitz, for example.
Correct, but they were not targeted specifically, meaning there was a boat, you know, that went to Rhodes weeks before the Allies entered Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans gathered the Jews of Rhodes, and there was one Jew living in the island of Karpathos.
Mm-hmm.
They went to the island of Karpathos to stop the whole boat, to load that one Jew that lived there, to take him to Piraeus, to deport him to Auschwitz.
Wow.
They didn't do that for the other ethnic groups they attacked, meaning the plan to annihilate the Jews was absolute.
Mm.
Together with the Jews, yes, homosexuals, Roma, Sinti, political dissidents, communists, yes. But not as, for example, the Roma that was targeted in Germany, they were not targeted in Greece. So the Roma in Greece are not victims of the German barbarity, but they targeted Roma and we speak about the Roma genocide during the Second World War, but these were Roma living in Central Europe, for example.
Mm.
just to give you a little bit the context, you know, the extermination of the Jews was central in the Nazi ideology. It wasn't a secondary topic. That's why I said even the trains had priority. That was a goal of the Nazi state.
Yeah. That's something I didn't know about.
So I mean, I've been to Auschwitz. I've done all this, but you know, I'll tell you, I've got some stories for you, but. But this is just so fascinating. I didn't know any of this either.
No, I mean, it speaks to the madness that they would go out of their way in such a way.
Yeah.
The only word that I can, to describe it, you know, in Greek is, it's mania, you know, like to... Yeah.
But when you know Germans...
An obsession.
Yeah, because they're very efficient, everything they do. And you think in a war, you'd want to save all your troops and use the Jewish community, their people as well. They could have helped the Germans in the war. They would have won. They got close to winning the war, but... Because they did what they had to do, exterminate the Jews. Do you know why they decided to do this? Is there any thought process of what made the Germans hate the Jews so much? Well, I don't know. It's a bad word.
I'm sure if you go to a library, there are volumes and volumes and kilometers of books written.
Like I've heard other versions.
Yeah,
but
and there are different
version?
Theories of you know...
Why don't I tell you what they teach us here, for example? One of the things that they taught us in high school was basically that, in its simplest form, at the end of World War One, the Weimar government of Germany that had Jewish representatives in it basically signed the surrender, effectively. And that was the easiest scapegoat, basically, for Hitler and his, you know, and his cronies, basically, to go ahead and do it. Is there any truth in that?
There is. Listen, again, nothing that happens has one explanation. You know,
of
everything
course.
Is a fusion.
It's very complex.
It's complex. And, you know, you have this Christian anti-Semitism. You know, for centuries, Jews were blamed for poisoning the wells. I spoke about bringing cholera, for example, or I spoke about the blood libel. So you have that. So the scapegoating, you have it in the Jewish communities living all around Europe for centuries. Mm. So people were inclined... to believe in all these conspiracies against the Jews. Then you have economic competition. You have this Christian-related anti-Semitism that we spoke also briefly about.
Yes.
Also, you know, in the Catholic Church, you know, burning of the witches and the conversion, the forced conversions. We spoke about the Inquisition. There was that as well. And somehow, add all that up, this crazy Nazi ideology, it created the perfect mix. And somehow the Jew became sort of like the easy victim, the easy solution. And blaming the Jew for everything, the people in Europe... It was a common language. The Jew at the time was both the capitalist, because there were some Jewish families that were doing very well and they owned their factories, but he was also the communist, because the Jews were also proletariat, and also many of the Jewish, of the communist leaders in the Soviet Union were Jews. Mm. So you have Nazi cartoons of the Jews controlling the world and of Jews being communists. And you have the Jews being sort of like cosmopolitans, but the Jews also who are becoming very nationalist. So you have everything, you know, the Jew... It's such a anti-Semitism, it's such a conspiracy that it can be sort of like applied to any historical time and it can serve any discourse. So recently, for example, we saw COVID. Why was COVID? The Jews did COVID to control the world or to make money. And you know, it's very easy. You just take any event that happens today and blame the Jews and somebody will believe it.
You reckon there's a bit of jealousy involved? Jews are very successful in business. They're good at business. They're very well to do. Do you think that's a good way to get back at people, create a story? Because it happens in our society sometimes. Do you think there might be some element of truth in that?
There is, definitely there is. Now, when you say Jews are good in business, some Jews are good in business. You know, some Jews in Australia are good in business. Some are actually very poor. Because, you know, you have like some Greeks are successful, some Greeks.
Sure.
So you
like
have
every
that,
culture.
You have every culture. Yeah. And that's the same thing. Like the Jewish community of Thessaloniki, when we speak, for example, here today, you had the 1-2% that was the ultra rich, but the vast majority were paupers, were very poor individuals, were in the tobacco industry or like working at the port as transporting goods. But somehow in the psyche of the anti-Semite, of course they are the rich. Because in the end of the day, it's the you have to ask the anti-Semite why the Jew has all these different mystical abilities, not the Jew, because the Jew in the mind of the anti-Semite is the creation of the anti-Semite. It's his own fantasy. You cannot ask me what's in the head of the anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Ask the anti-Semite why he's so obsessed with the Jews and why he thinks I control the world or I'm a communist or I'm rich or I'm all at the same time. It's not my prerogative. You see what I'm trying to
100%,
say?
It's
a psychosis. So meaning it's the shrink that has to ask the patient why he has this psychosis. It's not my issue why he has this psychosis.
Because it's incomprehensible. It just doesn't make sense.
It is. It's a lunacy.
Yeah. Like
it's a lunacy.
When we've traveled, I've done a lot of trips as well. Like I said, I've been to Auschwitz. No one could really answer it. No one really knows.
It's no, we don't. The other problem is because it's so crazy that the only way to understand this is to go into their minds.
Mm.
And once you go into their minds, you have to follow the Nazi ideology.
Mm.
So if you follow the Nazi ideology, yes, then it makes sense.
Mm.
But the Nazi ideology itself is lunatic.
Yeah.
So how can you sort of like follow a theory that's absolutely crazy to explain something?
Yeah.
You see, as a human, you cannot do that.
Mm.
But they did it somehow, and they still... You know, I speak to a German today, they still feel guilt and they still don't understand what's happening. You know, they still feel a huge role and responsibility about all these things.
This is what I wanted to ask you, because when it comes to the way that Hitler overtook that country and managed to, let's use the word brainwashed, managed to convert all of these people to believe this and managed to get an entire country behind this war effort. Are you surprised by the way that happened in that one period of history?
Your question is, how could Hitler in such a short way radicalize the German public opinion to follow him?
Effectively, yes.
And get him to be his troop soldiers. It didn't happen overnight. It happened with many years. Of course, the situations allowed it, but it didn't happen overnight. And I think that's the important lesson that comes for today, that what Hitler was doing, he did everything gradually. And the people gradually followed him. And for different reasons, different people followed him because they saw some value in them. For example, the industrialists who were anti-communists saw Hitler as a shield against communism. That was a threat to, let's say, the old European families at the time. You know, communism, the Soviet Union was becoming stronger and stronger at the time. It was many few years after the October Revolution. And different people believed in sort of like this ideology for their own reasons, but also it was... little by little. For example, he bans some political parties. Then he bans all political parties. Then he orchestrates the burning of the Reichstag. He blames it on this. Then he imprisons the political prisoners. Then it all happens gradually.
Yeah.
So this is when the society didn't have the alarms to react. And that's why we speak about the lessons of history, to understand these movements early on, to stop populism and extremism before they can go to the second step. When they are in the second and third step, it's too late.
Yeah.
The idea is to see these things early on. Dehumanization, attacking of minorities, diluting the rule of law, undermining democracy, freedom of the media. And we see it in many countries now, even in Europe.
It's topical right now as well.
Correct. Independent judiciary. All these things are signals of a country moving towards a dictatorship.
Yeah.
And this is what we have to prevent before that becomes. Definitely. When it becomes, and we have countries... We won't name them, but there are in Europe, for example, now that we see this thing happening, it's too late.
Yeah, because Joseph Goebbels, he said he wanted to control them from womb to tomb. And there's evidence of young German kids shooting their parents or dobbing in their parents. So it just goes beyond that. It's just a whole society of messed up people. It's incomprehensible. So it wasn't just killing the Jews. It's more like kids dobbing in their parents and shooting their parents, and you're going against the Third Reich and so forth. So
it was a terror state.
It was
a terror state where killing of the Jews was one of the big imperatives, but it wasn't only. And you know, it was everything that comes together with this totalitarian and you know extremist ideologies.
Yeah, and a lot of people probably didn't believe it or support it, but they had to because they were fearful. So kill the Jews. Yeah, even though they probably didn't believe it or they tried to hide it. So.
Well, how well known at the time was the fact that Jews were being taken to extermination camps in Germany?
Yeah, another big discussion. You know, there's a big discussion in Germany. And one thing is they were taken. Another thing, what was happening to them? Because the extent of what was happening was only revealed after liberation. You know, they were taken. Okay, they were going for labor. They were going for displacement. Mm. Nobody knew they were going for industrial murder, you know, creating factories of death. You know, think about it. We have scientists developing ways to effectively kill people.
Efficiently.
This is crazy.
Mm.
And even back then, you know, there were studies about German public opinion, what they knew. And you know, it's a lot was code.
Mm.
And the way they would know is that when their neighbor, the Jewish neighbor, was deported, and after, they would call it deportation, or they would have different code names. And after they didn't hear from him for 2 years, they realized he was probably dead. but nobody told them they were dead. Right. Everybody knew from the way the government probably giving the home to somebody else, and his job was replaced. They understood that he was not coming back,
right?
Because he was completely deleted from the community. But nobody told him he was exterminated.
It's effectively sweeping it under the rug to some
correct,
degree.
But I read once that, for example, somebody who was serving in a German submarine knew about that, even by serving in a submarine, like having no... But you don't know it by explicit orders. You know it by sort of like the sense of what's happening around you. So that was more or less it, rather than explicit sort of like knowledge about what was happening. It was the sense of what's happening.
Because am I right in saying that after the Allies moved in and took over the camps, they actually started bringing Germans through there to actually see it because there was some denial?
Correct. There's some of that. But even, you know, when Eisenhower entered, he asked them to film so that they could see the scenes so that people would not deny it after. You know, many, like today, for example, we have, unfortunately, Holocaust denial and distortion of people disputing some of these facts. But, you know, they were also, that's why they had the Nuremberg trials, to try to document everything that happened so that nobody could actually claim that these things never actually happened decades after.
So back to Thessaloniki now.
Yes.
So we said we had 50,000 1940s. How many ended up going? Was that Auschwitz? Was that the main
one?
Yes,
Auschwitz, more than 90%.
90%.
Yeah. So you have...
So what, 45,000? And 5,000, what, remained or hid?
So
they got hidden by Greeks.
Of the ones who returned, let's say three.
Oh, so some returned, yeah.
Yeah, the ones who are the Jews that are there are 2,000 Jews in now. It's very hard with numbers because you know.
Just approximates. Yeah.
Of course, but I'm saying some like a Jew who was deported and ended up in France maybe never be counted as a survivor because he ended up and started a new life in Paris, so he never came back. Yeah. But let's say three basic categories of survival. The ones are the ones who actually came back from the camps alive. Small number, around 1,200 maybe throughout the country of Holocaust survivors who came back. The ones who survived fighting with the partisans, the communist partisans in the mountains. And then the ones who hid in Greece with Greek families, with Greek Christian families. So these are the most or less the three basic forms of survival for Jews in occupied Greece at the time.
Because Larry Papadopoulos talked about his dad. He had, they're from Thessaloniki, and he protected Jews in his house as well. So, so someone we had on our podcast, his dad had a similar story. Yeah. Okay, so can we talk about Auschwitz now and what went on there?
Well, just before we get to that, I'm interested to hear, obviously you would have a personal connection to this in your own personal family stories. What is your direct family story and connection to and connection to it?
So my four grandparents, who are contemporary of this event, my paternal grandfather, after whom I'm named, he was at the time to join the Greek army. So he was in the Peloponnese for training. And then after Greece capitulated, they told him there's no more Greek army. So he left from the Peloponnese, he went to Athens. And there he hid in Chalkida, in the mountains, and he became a teacher with the guerrillas, with the communist guerrillas. And this is where he met my grandmother, who was living in Athens and also was hiding in Chalkida.
So is that Zervas, Napoleon Zervas, his men?
I don't know of which the different divisions he was. There was Zervas, there was the last, there was different units.
Yep.
My maternal grandfather, he was hiding with a Christian family on the border with Bulgaria in a lake called Kirkini in Macedonia, and he was a shepherd, so he was guarding the sheep for that family.
Perfect.
My maternal grandmother, she was originally from Drama, and from Drama they came to Salonika, and from Salonika they moved to Athens, because Athens initially was under Italian control, so it was easier for the Jews to hide. So they moved to Athens by crossing the borderline around Larissa, then they could easily go to Athens. Sorry. But all their families, most of their families, around 50 family members from each of these grandparents were lost in the Holocaust.
Wow.
So many of my grandparents were probably the only survivor of their families.
Unbelievable.
And how back does your generation go in Greece? So was it your great-grandparents?
No, so from the 15th century, from the...
Wow, that far back.
Yeah, from the Spanish Inquisition, you know. we are natives of the lands for more than 500 years.
Unbelievable.
More Greek than Greeks in there.
That's a good question because, you know, at what point do you become Greek? You know what I mean?
Like, true. So, look, as you said earlier, I have been to Auschwitz and Birkenau, and it was really moving. And I was 21. I was a kid. You know, I read it, I studied it at school, but it just really blew me away. And what blew me away was actually, it was really eerie. I walked along the train tracks, and it was like a really misty day, and I could see the main gates as well. I actually wrote it in my diary. I had to read my diary because it was so long ago. And I felt there was a presence around me. I was on my own, but I felt like an eerie presence around me, and it felt like it was thick. It was a thick presence. I couldn't explain it why. I didn't really explain it why. But the point of the story is, I followed a tour guide as well, and some of the stories they told me just blew me away. Every train that would go in, 25% of them would leave, and the 75% would just go from the train carriage straight to get gassed, is what they're saying. The Germans got that efficient where they used three tablets, and they'd drop them in, and the gas would start from the bottom. I think I read 2,000. It squeezed 2,000 in the chamber, and they'd kill them within 20 minutes. And there was other Jews who their job was to take these dead bodies and put them on tracks and then burn
them. Many of them were Greek Jews.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
That was one story I read.
You have testimonies of some of them who survived.
Yeah, definitely. But there was another one that blew me away as well. So there were actually horse stables. The tour guide that took us around said they normally fit 52 horses in these stables, but they had 1,000 people in them. So they jammed 1,000 people in. And one of them was a Greek Jew, and he wrote a note to his wife. He said, "We're going to die, blah, blah." I think he'd put it in a can or he hid it somewhere.
In a bottle, and it was found.
Yes.
And it was published recently, yes.
Beautiful. Yeah, yeah, 1985, yeah. I think
Nigeria,
it was.
Yeah.
And they found his wife. Yeah, so they got they translated the letter, and they found his wife, and they gave it to her 40 years later.
Yeah, correct.
So you know about that one.
Correct. Yeah. It's a well-known story, and it's very interesting because he writes in Greek, and he writes very patriotic Greek messages. He says, "I wish my motherland is liberated, and I want to go back." And it's very moving text to think that somebody in Auschwitz, about to die, is wanting to see Greece liberated. You know, it's very heartwarming.
Can you tell us any other stories as well? Well, I know you've written books on it, but
I focus mostly on the life of the Jews in the city. I'm not going to the camps. The camps is a very particular universe for research. But there is Primo Levi, who is the very famous Italian Holocaust survivor, one of the first to write his memoirs, who spoke about the Greek Jews as a very unified group of helping each other, but also sort of like being involved in a different small-time sort of like black market activities just to sustain them and to allow them to live in those difficult areas. And the thing that's interesting with the Jews of Greece is that, as we say, they spoke Greek, they spoke Turkish, they spoke Spanish, they spoke French. They didn't speak Polish, they didn't speak German, they didn't speak Hungarian, they didn't speak Russian. Mm. The majority of the people were from those places. So it was very hard for them to communicate and to survive. That's why they had to be a very tightly knit group
to
be able to stick together, to help each other and to survive.
Do you want to tell us about one of your books?
The Do Not Forget Me.
Well, that's the one I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
So the letters. Tell us about what it is and how you came to be able to compile it.
In what we are discussing today and trying to sort of like map Salonika, Thessaloniki in the Second World War, for me, I always looked for sort of like eyewitness accounts. How was the ordinary people experiencing this period? How were they living? What was their preoccupation? What did they know exactly? All this discussion we're having, did they know what's happening? How were they thinking? I was looking for eyewitness accounts. Not so much, I would find the government documents, the correspondence, the newspaper articles, but this is very sterilized talk. And from sort of like different hints in scholarship, I found about mentions of these letters. So when I asked, can I get a copy of this letter? You know, initially it was one or two letters that I read about. They told me, which one you have? We have several. I say, all of them. So from one day to the other, I'm here with some 50 letters, written by three Jewish mothers living in Thessaloniki, experiencing all these events that we're discussing, writing to their sons in Athens. So the sons are hiding or living in Athens. And you have a common motif. You have a mother living in Thessaloniki writing to a son. describing exactly the same events as they unroll. And after I found those letters, and sort of like they're written in cursive French, so transcribe them, translate them, edit them, I found that historically they're so important, so unique material, that I said that if I just put them in my PhD dissertation, it would just be lost. So they should be sort of like highlighted separately in another publication. And the book came out in Greek a few years ago, I think 5 years ago, 2017. And it came out in English last year. And now in the fall, we're coming out in French. And really it was a very big editorial success in Greece. It was a documentary made that also the president of Greece, Katerina Sakellaropoulou, reads some of these letters in a very moving and meaningful way. There was a theater play being done in Cyprus based on the letters. There is now two plays currently in Athens being developed. A lot of school projects, a lot of... So really, because of this, not only because of this description of these contemporary events from the perspective of a simple person, a simple lady, a simple woman, a simple mother who writes, but also because of the love that everything is written with this love to the sun. You know, you have all these tragic events, not written from the sterile pen of a historian, but from a loving hand of a mother to the sun. And you see all these horrible events that are happening and unfolding through this prism. And that's how I think that these letters are something that people appreciate and they find meaningful to read and moving. And I'm happy that, you know, they're I'm able to honor all these innocent victims through the stories of ordinary people.
Absolutely. Were you surprised by the fact that no one had actually done anything with these letters or seen the kind of value that, you know, putting them together to tell that story would actually do, to the point where the Greek president would be involved in doing something like that?
You know, as a historian, you always want some to find, you know, the little gem that nobody else found before you. But it's...
Well, clearly they knew about it and it existed, but you know, it took you to do to compile it, though.
Fair enough. But it's also the fact that I found, as I was going on with my research, I found three different sources, three different archives that had these letters. So I could create a compilation because just one of them was not enough. But when I found these three series of letters, that is a total of 53 letters, I said, okay, that's enough material that can become a singular publication and had the impact it had. If it was just one of them, and you know, I also found on my way, I found other letters as well, but they were written between two sisters, or between a father and a daughter, or between, or they were more one or two, not a series. But if I put them, I would think I would dilute this sort of like common motif that exists throughout the book. Of the mother writing to the son, you know, which is very powerful. You know, we're all sons of our mothers and we all know what the mother's love means. And seeing the mother love through this prism of sort of like genocide.
Was there a difference in terms of the tone of the letters between the mothers and the sons?
Now, the sons, we don't have the letters. The letters don't survive because we only have the letters of the mothers who were sent to Athens. We have a change of the tone of the mothers. As the situation becomes more difficult, as the Nazi measures intensify, initially, they are more careful when they describe what's happening to them. Maybe not to worry their sons, typical Greek mother. Or maybe they try to keep some hope. But when they see the trains deported, they're leaving, they see what's happening in the ghetto, they see the situation in the city, they really break down. And they really, the last letters are really heartbreaking and they really very upsetting and moving.
Very heavy, isn't it?
We've done how many episodes of this podcast now? It's we're well into the 30s now, and this is probably the first time that I've, you know, that I've thought it's very moving. It's very touching. Where do you go from there?
Well, let's speak about liberation.
Yes, that's probably a good
time. You know, the end of the war.
Yes, good story.
The life from the beginning again, you know, restarting lives.
You really have got us in this. I'm being genuine when I say that it's very touching to hear these, you know, these stories, and it's... And not just, I mean, it's really upsetting to think, because this wasn't that long ago that these things were happening. And, you know, it's still in the living memory of people who, you know, who were there and have tattoos on their, you know, on their bodies and all that sort of thing, you know, as evidence of it. It's
But even, shocking. You know, yes, you have that, which you still have survivors. You still have people who profess some of these ideologies. But you know, me and the general consul, we met in Geneva at the United Nations some years ago. We're both young, but you know, it was a few years ago. And you know, the UN was founded at the end of the Second World War, seeing the atrocities of the war and the Holocaust, with the promise of never again. So all the international system that we have today, all the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all the international human rights legislation, the European Union that Greece is a proud member of, all these were created to stop again another war from emerging in Europe. So the war is still alive today through all the instruments that we have today. All the memory of the international human rights system that we have today is because of the Second World War.
Yeah.
If you study law today, if you study diplomacy today, if you discuss history today, politics today, it's all based on that experience. I mean, it was so groundbreaking, this experience of the Second World War, that everything till today is based on that experience. So when the young people say it's too far away, it's not for me, well, they cannot be good lawyers. They cannot be good diplomats.
It's embedded in our society now.
It is part of, it's so strong in our culture.
Yeah,
it's the reason why we're here, really.
True.
It's all the reason why our families migrated.
Yeah. But you're right, it's so we're like my generation, I'm like the grandkid of that generation who wouldn't have lived through all. So now my kids, for example, they wouldn't have no connection to it, you know. That's why it's really important to what we're doing.
Well, to document the stories. And yes, this is one way of doing it, obviously via a podcast and your books and whatnot. It's very important.
Because you said earlier, there's people that don't think it actually happened now. So all that gossip and innuendo is kicking in now.
Correct. And you have, you know, now, of course, education, of course, now emerges as the big imperative of governments to educate the young people, you know, integrate all these things at schools. But also, you know, you have the power of social media. And you spread in social media, all these conspiracies can spread like wildfire.
Yep.
So the problem is now that we have a huge distortion of the Holocaust on social media. And it's very hard to control all this. And, you know, your children are getting the information not from you or the newspapers or, I don't know, documentaries or TV. They get from TikTok and Facebook and Instagram.
And
how can you police Instagram and TikTok when there's thousands of videos, of hours of videos uploaded every second? You know, we speak about the human... And if they see something there, how can you answer that? You know, how can you... So this is the big challenge, I think, of our times. And, you know, we work very hard with the United Nations, with UNESCO, with other international organizations to develop this educational material, this knowledge, working with social media companies to stop hate, to stop the spreading of misinformation and disinformation, and of course, Holocaust denial and distortion. Because it's imperative, we cannot build strong, resilient societies today when hate can spread on our phones.
Yeah. Look, very important lessons we need to learn from it as well. So just on Thessaloniki, it was known as the mother of Israel, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
So how is it today in modern day?
So, you know,
is it thriving? Have they come back, the Jewish people? Have they multiplied?
Thessaloniki is a thriving metropolis of a million people, as you may know.
Beautiful city.
The second biggest city of Greece. The Jewish community is around 1,500 people.
Okay, wow.
So it's rather small, but still visible and active and prominent. Very active in the cultural life, the political life, the business life of the city. The community maintains three synagogues in Thessaloniki, a Jewish school. There's a cemetery, of course. There is an elder's home. And there's a summer camp and activities throughout the year. Very well connected with the city administration, the government, the local authorities. A Holocaust museum now is being constructed to tell the story. There's also a Jewish museum in the city. And now you also have a big sort of like upsurgence of Jewish life, because not only you have the Greek population that's becoming, the Greek Christian population that's becoming very interested, the government really showcasing that story and speaking about it and including it to the school curricula, but also you have tourists. All these tourists who come to Thessaloniki now, they want to get exposed to this Jewish and this multicultural history of Thessaloniki. So not only Jews themselves, you have a lot of Israelis, of course, who come, and French Jews and American Jews who come and visit Thessaloniki with roots. Even today we met here in Sydney Australians with Greek Jewish roots who care about this you know, Thessaloniki and what's happening today. But even beyond, you know, you have the famous book of Mark Mazau or Salonika City of Ghosts that really introduced Salonika, Thessaloniki, the history to the international audience. So all these things are things that are now very visible in the city. The city, I think, has also get over some of these taboos of the past. more and more they speak openly about all these different communities that existed and all this rich history and diverse history. So I think it's a good future for the city and for the country. And the more open we are, the more inclusive we are, the more able we are to reconcile all the different identities that we have, and not to have any skeletons in the closet. Because the worst thing is to have all these skeletons in the closet, because they amass, and then, you know, you can lie once, but if you continue lying, then there's, you know, there's no future.
Yeah. Well, obviously, there's a lot of positives going there, and we're very glad to hear that. In recent years, though, over the last sort of decade, we have seen a reemergence, as we mentioned earlier, of a sort of neo-Nazi parties, for example, and that ideology starting to resurface in some ways. What's your initial reaction to these sorts of things happening, and how, I mean, I think we've seen in recent weeks, Nick, that the government has gone to lengths to ban these types of parties from running in future. How do you see it?
For me, it's also, it's a multiple factors, of course. It's one, a sign of times. As we all said, these are generations that are not exposed to that period, so they've become a prey to these ideologies easier than people who have lived through these events, who know what Nazism and all these extremism ideologies mean. We increased, we also had the economic crisis that was, of course, with migration. So again, scapegoating of the immigrants, of the other, was the easy way out. But also, I think it's because we neglected to educate our young people about the Holocaust and anti-Semitism for many decades in Greece. So somehow these extremists found fertile ground. And I think now the government realized, now they are actually compiling a national action plan against anti-Semitism. That's government-wide, all agencies of government, from the police to Ministry of Education and beyond, to integrate all these things to the lessons that our youth learns and our citizens learn, to prevent such things from happening. Because you can ban as many parties as you want,
yes,
but it's not banning the party that matters. It's stopping the people from voting them.
True.
For me, it's number one, stopping for people to vote them, but also building the resilience of the healthy sectors of society. Because you're always going to have extremists in any society. But the point is to keep the extremists at the sides. Never give them a loudspeaker. Never enable them to go beyond living on the edge of society. And I think that's what we have to learn. Mm-hmm. How, yes, unfortunately, there will be from the left and from the right people
extreme
either end. Yeah. But they should never be able to get more integrated into the main discourse. You always have people expressing fringe ideologies, fringe ideas, vandalizing maybe a Holocaust monument, a Jewish cemetery, but this will remain at the fringe. And the society, the healthy elements, the government, the local authorities, the universities, the media, the intellectuals, the regular citizens have to come and condemn all these manifestations. Because if we tolerate them, then it's exactly the mistakes we did in the past, whereby tolerating of these people, then you enable them, and then there's nobody else left to oppose them when they become even more crazy in their ideology.
It's a good point. Yeah, you can't just not do anything and ignore it, think it'll go away. They'll just chip away, like we learned in the 1940s.
I'm very grateful to Leon for coming here. Yeah, it's not an easy trip from Geneva to the other side of the world. I think the main challenge for all of us here, since I've been here for more than half a year, is to sensitize and raise awareness amongst the Greek-Australian community as well. Being of Greek descent, I feel it imperative for them to know this story, the story of their compatriots, of people who were almost erased from the map, and we should know issues that maybe we feel sometimes uncomfortable with, because that creates a better future for us and for our children when we know, you know, the truth, and when we can raise issues that sometimes may bring us in a difficult situation. So I'm glad he came here, and that he will speak also to the Greek community on Thursday. And I'm also grateful to the Archbishop, because he will speak as well on Thursday. And he will speak about the role of the Orthodox Church in saving many lives of Greek Jews during the Nazi occupation, with an emphasis on Archbishop Damaskinos in Athens, and on the bishops in Zakynthos and Volos, which showed that the church played an important role, a positive role as well. It is something that we should be proud of as Greeks.
It's interesting because you do hear a lot of stories about this and that have come out over the years. You know, the one from Zakynthos in particular. Another story, obviously, around Princess Alice as well, who received an award, I understand, as well.
Correct, yeah. What movie was that in? Was it Captain Corelli's Mandolin? There was a scene in that about it, wasn't it?
Princess Alice? No, that was...
The Crown. In The Crown.
That was in The Crown, actually, yeah. Yes. An amazing story.
I mean, like the priest, the Italian said, we need to a list of all your Jews in the island of Kefalonia.
I don't think that was depicted in that film.
No, that was not.
That was Zakynthos. Yeah.
Ah, right. And the priest and the mayor, Alice, well, they were out names. Yeah, okay.
Alice, she saved the Jewish family in Athens. And
for context,
the
Prince Alice,
Philip.
Yes.
Mm. Prince Philip.
Prince Philip, the grandmother of King Charles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Unbelievable stories. There's so much we can talk about, and there's so much that's still yet to come out. I'm sure there's a lot. I'm suspecting there are plenty more books to be had and many more talks, and we'll be following closely. All the very best for the rest of this speaking tour. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for educating us. Because as I said earlier, this is something that, as a Greek community, we don't know enough about. So... Leon, thank you so much for being here on Ouzo Talk and for giving these stories over to us.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Tom. It was a great pleasure and an honor to be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And Yanni, thank you for helping to bring Leon out for us. You're almost a producer at this point.
Slowly.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Good Nick, stuff. Mate, anything to add to that, mate?
Look, I'm going to be in Yanina in a few months, actually. So is there a Greek... Jewish community still
of course,
in Yanina?
Yeah.
And look out for them.
Yeah, you should definitely visit the synagogue. Let me know. I can facilitate that.
Yeah, definitely. I think I will, actually. Yeah, look.
There might be a trip for you and I, mate.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, you'll be there too. Actually.
I will be.
Yeah. Countdown's on.
It is.
Yeah, no, look, Leon, that blew me away. And honestly, we don't normally get emotional on this, but
it did
really
get heavy
us.
There for a moment.
It did. It took a while to digest some of that stuff that you were saying. But look, thank you so much, honestly, coming out here, saying the story that you had to say. And a lot of us, we didn't know any of half this stuff.
No.
And it's great. We're education, not just us in Sydney, but all around the world. We've hit, 97 countries now, Tom?
97 countries now.
And we've got listeners in Israel. So
we do.
They'd love to hear this story. So,
great.
Yeah, fantastic. Look, thank you once again, Tom.
Yeah, look, ouzotalk@outlook.com is the email. Follow us on social media at ouzotalk or at ouzo_talk. On Instagram, that one is actually... I was bound to get it wrong on some episode, wasn't I? Thank you very much, guys, and we'll see you next time. Nick Athanasiou, thank you, mate.
Tom, thank you, everyone. Bye.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.